Hi, I'm Mike Gaswood, CEO of Tricert Financial Group. Welcome to another episode of In Focus. Today, I'm joined by Brian Durno, the lead of our Investment Management and Strategy Group. Welcome, Brian.
Thanks, Mike. Good to be here.
Great to have you on. Today, folks, we've got a show about quality, and this is where things get a little philosophical. Well, maybe philosophical, but we're going to talk about quality in the QSECT approach. And I just want listeners to know that Brian and I are both, call it amateur philosophers, or at least we read some philosophy and pretend like we know philosophy. But one book that we both mentioned we were preparing for this show was Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. Now, this is something that is not a light read, but one of the aspects to that novel by Robert Persig is quality. And it's interesting, and the poor guy kind of goes through some tough times as he's trying to struggle with what is quality, trying to define quality. And his context was in the context of writing style, as he was a professor trying to teach writing, and then what was the definition of quality writing. The good news is we're not asking Brian to do anything that esoteric. We're actually talking about, well, what is the definition of quality as we look to pick various equities in our clients' portfolios, in the core pick list. And so, Brian, why don't we start there? How do you define quality?
Sure. Yeah, well, this is an interesting area of discussion. Quality has some academic reference, and we don't necessarily buy into the complete academic definition of quality here, because actually the quality factor itself has many different definitions. A lot of the other factors may have more consistent definitions amongst the academic community, but quality is one of those ones that, different firms will define it differently. So it is useful for us to explain ourselves about what we mean by quality.
And when you say the academic community, you mean from a portfolio management perspective or an investment management perspective?
That's right.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about the differences. How do we see it?
So we kind of think of it, a great way to think of it is if you, let's just say you sold your business and you've now, you've got your, life's capital in one chunk lump sum and you want to decide what to do next. And if you walk through the franchise show to try to decide what to do next, and you're thinking as a business person would about what kind of business would you be willing to put down large sums of capital to work in the rest of your life, that starts the definition of what quality looks like for us on our side. So when you're walking through the franchise show, you'd see various booths. You see lots of different pitches about why a certain business would look great or not so great, depending on the booth and the sales guy in front of it. But the whole idea of what would go through your mind when you're going across all these different booths and asking questions is very much the same kind of process that we would use when we're trying to select securities.
So that's a good analogy, like this whole notion of a franchise, again, back to an investment, something I think a lot of people could relate to, especially our clients, many of them owner operators. So yeah, keep going. What would we look at?
So it's not unlike, because obviously you're going to have a long-term perspective here. You're not entering the franchise show thinking you're going to buy something and sell it in 6 months from now. So you'd be thinking more about, let's say, the revenue growth. Is it stable? Is it understandable where the source of the revenue growth is coming from? Now, obviously, it would help if it has a long historical track record to prove that stability. But even in the case of new burgeoning industries, you have to be able to get your head around the fact that this is a longer-term trend that might be secular in nature to give you comfort that the revenue won't be fighting against you. And then you'd probably want to look at the competitive threats. You may already have some knowledge of the competition, but in most cases, if you're starting a new business, you'd really want to explore those competitive threats and then try to figure out if they can be understood, if they can be managed. There are very few capitalist businesses that aren't facing competition in some form. And most of the purposes of this competition is not friendly in nature.
Right.
They're trying to outsell you and outcompete you and, have a cost structure that's lower than yours. And, it's a very competitive business. So you have to take that very seriously.
Okay. What else?
Maybe a few other things. Market share. We would probably agree with most of the research that suggests that dominance in market share leads to higher returns on equity and returns on invested capital. So being, you know, a leader in an industry has many, many advantages, including price and costs and scale advantages. But market share is a very important element when you're trying to decide to invest in a business for a long period of time. But I would say one of the more important ones that might get overlooked, or maybe it's so obvious that some folks think it's not as important as it really is, but it's this idea, is the business a value-creating business? And so what does that mean? What's a value-creating business? And the easiest way to think about this is, you know, lots of people can confuse growth with a value-creating business, which is obviously growth is a certain component of something you'd be attracted to as a, as an entrepreneur or a business person. But growth right. in and of itself isn't necessarily a positive thing. You need to find out if the growth is earning a return on capital that's higher than your cost of capital.
Right. And that's really important because a lot of companies, and sometimes it can be, it can come back to the stage that the company's in, but this is a really good point. Elaborate, please.
Yeah. Well, it's almost like, you know, if you think of a machine and if it costs you $10 to play a machine, and the machine spits out $10, then it really doesn't matter if you play hundreds and thousands of these machines, because you're never actually going to get ahead. You're just going to be putting in $10 and getting $10 back. And so there's measurements in the financial world that we can do, to get your head around whether or not you're actually returning a return on your invested capital that's higher than your cost of capital. So those are traditional, like return on equity, return on invested capital, maybe tangible capital. There's lots of different metrics we would use to get at this. But the fundamental idea is that we're looking for machines that if you put $10 in, you get $12 back, or 15, or 25, or 30. Because in that case, right. growth will create value that can be returned to shareholders either through dividends or buybacks.
Exactly. And to be clear, the machine we're talking about is not a slot machine. This is some fictional machine that magically you put. There's no gambling necessarily here other than maybe predicting. But the idea here is, yeah, you put money in, will you get more? I mean, it's simple when you say it, but you put money in, will you get more money out? And now that money is basically not necessarily the money that the shareholders are investing or a shareholder would invest when they're purchasing equity. We're talking about money that the, you know, maybe it's the retained earnings or the shareholder equity, so to speak, that they have, again, back to the point, the capital that they're investing to try and grow the business, but you can't just always grow at all costs.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And most businesses do require some form of capital to grow. And that's totally fine. It's being able to measure that growth will have a return that's higher than the cost to get that growth. And that's, so the machine analogy was never meant to be, I didn't mean to make it sound like some sort of gambling machine. That's for sure not what we're talking about. It is right. more conceptual that you exactly. know, a business is ultimately just a machine that you can invest capital into, you know, and you know, a good example there, like if you look at a company that, you know, a traditional, you know, someone might call cheap that trades at a very low, let's say a low price to book value, let's say right. below one. So in other words, yeah. the business is trading for less than what it's worth. And some folks might call that, you know, obviously a cheap stock. But if the business has a return on equity, let's say it's 4%, and the cost of capital for that business is 10%, right. then there might be, you know, so in this case, with that example, growth would destroy value, not create it.
Right.
So
right.
the market may be actually right in pricing certain stocks with a price to book value below one. So there's a lot more to the story than just your, let's say, metric that you might look at in the newspaper or online. You really do have to kind of roll up your sleeves and determine if the company is earning a cost of capital above their cost of capital.
And a lot of this, there's still, I mean, there is still a bit of an art to this. It's not just looking at the numbers because, as you said, you have to understand, well, great, you've got a snapshot in time. That's the data. But the challenge with this business is, and investing is looking towards the future. What may happen in the future? That's the rub in all of this.
Yeah. And then, of course, because it's competitive in public stock markets, you know, they're picked over. So if you happen to put $10 into a machine and get $25 back, I can assure you, you will not be the only one that knows about that machine. And so quickly what happens in the marketplace, of course, is the price will rise to reflect the good fortunes of this machine, this fictional machine, of course. And so you might find that the price goes up to play that machine to $24. So you're still putting in 24 and getting back 25. So you're still creating value, but the market will not sit still. This is what makes our business so very tricky, is you certainly have lots of analytical data to help you identify what you want, but you're not the only one competing to make the price change every day.
Right. I want to come back to what you said when it came to the revenue stable and understandable growth, right? Talk more about that. How do we, you know, in terms of you and the team, how do they go about trying to understand the growth?
Sure. So a lot of times when we listen to management calls, there's some subjective qualitative stuff here, and there's some quantitative stuff that sort of you blend in together. And then over many, many years of experience, you start to hone in on where the truth is, but you're still making estimates about the future. And so obviously we would argue that it's probably a little bit easier to imagine a stability of revenue growth in the future if it has a long track record of history behind it and no disruptive innovator that's attacking their revenue streams in the current moment.
Right.
That might sound easier than it is to actually find, but that is one of the things that's very important.
Okay. And then on the competitive front, same thing. How do you, you know, jumping from industry to industry, what kind of information does the team rely on in terms of, again, understanding the competitive landscapes and how a holding is, or a possible holding is positioned?
Sure. Yeah. And the sources of a company's competitive advantage, there's many, many different sources of competitive advantage. And if I think of the one that might be the hardest, is network effects, or something you see in, let's say, the technology sector, where a company can have absolute dominance for a period of time. And so there's sort of a network effect that happens in some software companies where you're almost, you know, crazy to use any other software than, you know, certain companies, because it's so dominant and it's so used by everybody else that you kind of have to change to go to the mainstream supplier. But, those can also change quickly. And because of the zero sum nature of that competitive threat, you can have sea changes very quickly. You can think of BlackBerry's experience against Apple as an example of this, and how fast a business can be made to be not as competitive as the others. So we prefer now that's not impossible to deal with, of course, in the market. And of course, by being diversified, you inherently protect yourself from these sort of singular bets. But you might find it interesting to look at other sources of competitive advantage that haven't changed over a long period of time. Like, let's say, for example, paying higher than their cost for Tide soap.
Right.
What is it that makes us do this? And what certain behaviors have been entrenched in, let's say, our, you know, history that would be, let's say, more predictable. And so some of the consumer products have these kinds of elements.
So talk about how, okay, so we're in the franchise show. You've talked about some, you know, many of the metrics that you and the team are looking at, or again, using the analogy that I would be, say, I would be looking at when I'm going through the franchise shows. How do I bring it all together? Are they, you know, are all of these elements equally weighted? Am I always looking for the most perfect fit across all of those? How do we bring it all together?
Yeah. Well, it's funny. Even when you find that business that has the perfect fit and checks all the boxes, the next hardest part is, of course, valuation.
Right.
what will you pay? Because, you know, if you overpay for a super high quality business, then that sin of overpaying may be with you, in spite of the fact that the business underlying fundamentals may be incredibly strong. And I can think of companies, even in my own experience through my career, companies like Walmart, that, you know, this is not a tech stock or a, you know, change the world kind of technology behind it. But they had an experience where they were trading around 60 or 70 times their earnings in the late 90s.
Right.
And the company actually for the, you know, from, let's say, 2000 to 2010, tripled their earnings. So a fantastic fundamental experience there. But because you paid 70 times to get in it, your performance as a stockholder of that company for that 10-year period was actually flat to down. So you're left with the terrible sin of overpaying, that always sort of is your last double check. So finding those, let's say, lovely quality characteristics that we described is let's say half of it, and the other half is paying the right price.
And so that comes back to, and again, back to the franchise analogy. I find something, I go, yeah, okay, this looks good, but then you see what they're asking for. And this, you know, call it the quant aspect for what we do. We basically run a bunch of models and numbers and say, yeah, this is still, even though the, you know, this is a great company, the price right now just doesn't compute.
That's right. And if we have to wait, you know, we sort of have our wish list of companies that we really like. We've got a good sense of what great companies are out there. But sometimes the valuations aren't great. So there's always a difference between the valuation and the business. They're two different things. But if you have your shopping cart ready and your little list ready, sometimes the market can do crazy things and give you an opportunity to act.
And that's a really good point. I always try and stress that whenever I can, is that the market, you know, back to efficiencies, you know, the efficiency is it reacting to information or information flow, very efficient. Efficiency doesn't mean rational. And so if we can leverage the irrational aspects of the market, that's only better for our clients.
That's right. Yeah. And if I think of the kinds of companies that we would collect around just to sort of make it real, they're generally larger in nature. They generally pay dividends. Their balance sheets are generally strong. If I think of a couple, let's say key characteristics of these kinds of businesses, like you can almost look for the symptom instead of the disease, you know, that the symptom would be rising dividends. And so I think over the last 10 years, I think I wrote this down before I came. Yeah, I did. The average growth rate in dividends for our core picks over the last 10 years is about 11% per year.
11% per year.
That's right.
Wow. That's an impressive number.
Yeah. And that goes a long ways to helping your clients, and our clients are relatively conservative, and keeping up with inflation on the equity side is one of the reasons why you have equities. And in spite of the ups and downs in the market, which can be terribly unpredictable in the short term, dividends come in your account every quarter in cash. So an 11% right. growth rate does go a long ways to cushion the blow during periods of ups and downs in the marketplace.
Again, and it's, you know, back to, you know, we talk about our overall process in KYC, knowing our clients and understanding the definition of quality, so that when the market does go volatile to the negative, that clients can have comfort that, to your point, the dividends continue, because we went through quite a period of volatility, and yet the dividends keep coming in. They keep, most times, hopefully, they continue to grow, like back to the process. And
that's right.
So, and again, it gives clients that comfort feeling to stay in the market, to stay with our approach as we look towards the long term.
That's right. And that long term part is clearly very, very important for equity investors.
Excellent. Brian, thanks for this.
Thanks for having me.
Folks, as always, if you have any questions, feel free to reach out to your financial advisor, talk to your TriCert Investment Counsel portfolio manager, or don't hesitate to reach out to myself. Take care.